This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Our first question this month comes from John Brooks. He says, the 1970 Reader Digest Atlas of the Universe states that the Milky Way contains 100,000 million stars. Today, with our advanced technology, the figures range vastly from 100 billion to 400 billion stars. So which is it? Surely now, 44 years later, we would have a much more accurate figure than to just still say between 100 and 400 billion stars.
Surprisingly, we can't really do any better these days. The problem is that while we've got a very good idea of how many big, bright stars there are in the galaxy, we have very little idea of how many small, faint ones there are. You can consider the question of what it takes to become a star, and generally we consider that to be about 13 times the mass of Jupiter. That's the smallest object that can really generate its own heat from nuclear fusion. But that heat is really very feeble. The smallest stars can only be about room temperature, some are even colder, and they're millions of times fainter than the Sun. They can't be seen in visible light, even by the world's largest telescopes. If the Sun was a cool brown dwarf, it would shine with the same intrinsic brightness as the planet Venus, except that it would appear black because it would only emit in the infrared. And these properties, this coolness, this faintness, makes it really difficult to detect them. It's only with the careful study of infrared data from satellites that astronomers have managed to identify the candidate objects recently. After that, they need further follow-up observation to see how they move in order to estimate how far away they are. That takes a lot of expensive telescope time, which is why we only know a handful of these really small objects. They're so faint that what we think are the 5th, 6th and 7th closest stars to the Sun have only been discovered in the last 2 years. If we want to know how many stars there are in the galaxy, from this handful of objects we've somehow got to extrapolate how many of these small stars there are in the entire Milky Way. There's many billions, no doubt, but it's hard to say exactly how many with any kind of reasonable accuracy. So many star counts ignore these very faint stars, and they only look at things that are about 80 times the size of Jupiter, or about the 12th of the size of the Sun. Objects this big are large enough that we can really think of them as stars, and they behave a little bit more like the stars that we'd expect to see. They're also a little easier to detect. Even then, it's kind of difficult to know how many there are. There's a lot of uncertainty in things like the structure of the galaxy, the relative contributions from young stars and old stars, and so forth. So we're doing pretty well to gauge things within a factor of 4 at the moment. However, we should have a handle on this in the near future. The Gaia satellite was launched late last year. It should measure the distances to a lot of the bright stars on this side of the galaxy, and that'll give us our real first empirical view of what the galaxy looks like. It also works using visible light, so it won't pick up the coolest, faintest, smallest stars still. But it will improve our accuracy on the distance of the largest stars immeasurably. So you never know, maybe in a few years' time when you're reading your astronomy textbook, we'll have a much more accurate figure for you. But not right now.
That's a good question and a really interesting answer. Astronomers don't know everything.
We try to.
We do try. The next question comes from André Joubert, who asks, what percentage of inner rocky planets will survive a hot Jupiter on its inward journey? Does this not reduce the estimates of habitable planets in the Milky Way?
For anyone not in the know, a hot Jupiter is a planet like Jupiter that orbits very close to its parent star. These can be pretty crazy planets. They orbit so close that a year might only last a few days, one day or even less in some cases. They can reach temperatures of over 1,000 degrees Celsius. And like our moon, they're tidally locked to their star, so they keep one superheated face pointing towards the star, and one cooler face facing the darkness of space. That leads to some pretty crazy weather. Supersonic winds try to equalize the temperature difference between the two faces. The planets can even cause tides, like we get on Earth, but rolling around on the surface of their host star. So they're pretty crazy places. But how they've got there has been a bit of a mystery until recently. Maybe they formed there, maybe they started out like our planet Jupiter and moved a lot closer to the star. We can guess the answer by measuring the angle between the equator of the star and the orbit of the planet going round the star using what's known as the Rossdon-McLaughlin effect. Now, since the star and the planet's formed out of the same rotating gas cloud, we normally expect the star's rotation and the planet's orbit to be in the same direction, like the Sun's and the Earth's is. We've found that quite a lot of these hot Jupiters orbit the star in an inclined orbit, and sometimes elongated. Some of them even orbit backwards. The easiest way to get the planet to orbit the star like this is to have some kind of gravitational dust-up, with another planet further out in the planetary system. The orbits of the two planets interact, one's kicked out of the system, and one's knocked towards the star. We've recently discovered some of these free-floating planets hurtling around between the stars. There's probably as many free-floating planets out there as there are actual stars, so there could be even 400 billion of them in our own galaxy. Now obviously this doesn't bode well if you're the planet that's ejected. and puny Earth-mass planets don't stand much of a chance in the face of a migrating Jupiter-mass planet. So seeing these planets may well be a signal of a stellar system in distress that's not going to be able to support life. But that's not necessarily the case. By measuring slight wobbles in these planets' orbits, we can test to see if there are other planets in the system. The Kepler satellites use these transit timing variations to find systems with not only a hot Jupiter, but with other gas giants orbiting close to the star. So it's not all doom and gloom. Planets can still exist in these systems. But what effect would this have on life? Well, the fraction of stars with hot Jupiters is only somewhere between 8% and 11%, and that gives you some idea of the differences involved. If we don't know how many stars there are in the galaxy to anything like that accuracy, the additional uncertainty factored in by an extra roughly 10% of hot Jupiters is comparatively small. So at the moment, we only have a rough estimate of the number of habitable planets in the galaxy anyway. Our current estimates are, on average, there's about one habitable planet per star. But even then, it depends on what you class as a habitable planet. If you class anything that could support life as we know it at some point in its existence, that definition can include Mars and sometimes Venus too. Although they didn't support life, they didn't develop life, there may have been the potential for life to have been there at some point. So for the few hundred billion stars in our galaxy, there are probably a few hundred billion habitable planets, but all the numbers are still highly uncertain at this point.
Thanks, that's an interesting answer and much to discover there. Finally, we've got two related questions here. The first one's from Jürgen Nilsson, who asks, what is wrong with this argument? First of all, a lot of the universe is moving away from us at speeds higher than c. When an object moves at c, its mass is infinite. We are therefore surrounded by a black hole. And Peter Ellinger asks, at the moment of the Big Bang, how come it went bang? Surely with everything in the universe being so close together, it would effectively be the biggest black hole ever and therefore having an impossibly high escape velocity. Surely this would have resulted in no bang whatsoever.
Well, we avoided a universal black hole because the early universe expanded faster than light. Yeah, you heard that right. Even though Einstein's theories of relativity predict that nothing can travel faster than the speed of light, the universe did actually expand faster than the speed of light. So does that mean Einstein was wrong? Well, not so fast. Let's rewind a bit. Why can't something travel faster than the speed of light? Well, it takes energy to move something, and energy is always conserved in the universe, so that energy has to go somewhere. Einstein showed that that energy gets absorbed by the thing that's being moved, adding to its mass, and making the object heavier. The more energy you put in, the heavier the object gets. Eventually, the mass becomes infinitely large and requires an infinite amount of energy to move. That point occurs when the object reaches the speed of light, and that's why nothing can go faster than the speed of light. Or can it? Our current theories of the Big Bang predict that space is expanding. The further away something is, the faster it's expanding away from us. Not only that, but some distance from us, everything is moving faster than the speed of light. How can this be? Well, speed is relative. That's Einstein's theory of relativity in a nutshell. You can't accelerate something from a standing stop to going faster than the speed of light. But that says nothing about the space around you. We can think of this concept like a fast car. Let's say I've got a car sitting on a test track here in Manchester. It's got a top speed of 270 miles an hour. That's quite a fast car, but no matter how hard I try, I can't accelerate it faster than that. However, the Earth's turning under me at 1,000 miles an hour, so even when it's not moving, it's already moving at 1,000 miles an hour. And it's orbiting the Sun at 18,500 miles an hour. And the Sun is orbiting the galaxy at 136,000 miles an hour. The galaxy is moving relative to the cosmic microwave background at 825,000 miles an hour. 825,000 miles an hour is a pretty fast car, but we don't normally consider these speeds because we're used to measuring things compared to where they are on the Earth's surface. Now, similarly, if we measure the motion of something in the universe, we expect some frame of reference, and that's effectively the space that the object's sitting on. This concept of space as a medium is quite important because the Big Bang wasn't like a conventional explosion. Material didn't fly away from a central point because of some applied pressure of an explosion. Space itself came into being, and it's been continuously created ever since. Now, that space has no mass, it's a vacuum, but it's still got physical properties, like an inertial frame. So as space expands, things are carried along with it. The space has no mass, and it's only moving with respect to the space next to it. So as space expands, anything in it gets carried along by that expansion, a bit like something stuck to the surface of an expanding balloon. Now, in the same way as our racing car can't move faster than its own top speed, nothing can move faster than the speed of light, but that's the speed of light relative to the space around it. It doesn't prevent the space in which it's sitting doing its own thing. So who knows, maybe one of these days we'll be able to harness this concept and create warp drive, and then we can start living our dreams and have some hammy captain, get involved with some fist fighting, and improbable romantic situations with some highly dubious alien species.
That would be living the dream indeed. Well, thanks a lot for answering all those questions, Ian.
You're quite welcome.
And if you have any of your own questions, feel free to leave them the address on the Jodcast website.